Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. On the exact same day in 2009, Ellen McCarthy got her dream job as wedding reporter for The Washington Post, and she broke up with the guy she'd been dating for the past year and a half. Given that she was, of course, 30 when all this went down, it could have been the makings of a rom-com-worthy crisis. Instead, McCarthy used her hundreds of interviews with happy couples at all stages of life to draw some valuable lessons that have lasted her from meeting and dating the man who is now her husband into a marriage that looks likely to withstand the transition from the honeymoon stage to the fulfillment of a long and happy life. She shares some of what she discovered in her new book, The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. Ellen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Some people might assume weddings would be like a frivolous beat. Why was it so important to you to take this job seriously?
Yeah, I actually was really conflicted about it. They had created this new page at the behest of our publisher, who had always enjoyed the New York Times vows column. And I had been at the Post by that time, you know, for over a decade and had done hard news and been an arts and entertainment reporter and was, you know, pretty happy with my current position. And I had reservations about becoming kind of the newsroom cream puff, which I knew I would be if I took this gig. You know, the weddings beat is not exactly the fast track to the Pentagon. But I really always wanted to write about people. And to my mind, this was one of the ways to write about the most important story and facet of people's lives, which is their interpersonal relationships. And so once I realized that this was a way for me to look deeply at human beings and the human experience, then I really got excited about the endeavor.
One major conclusion you come to is that in the modern world, we tend to expect a lot more from relationships than we are willing to put into them. Why is it that we're better about like maintaining our teeth and our cars than our marriages and our long-term relationships?
Isn't that interesting? I think it comes down to a sort of societal expectation that relationships are magic and that when we find the right one, then we've done our job and it's game over and everything else should fall exactly into place, and that we shouldn't have to do any work or put in any effort to maintain it. You know, I always think it's so interesting how much effort people put into planning a wedding, months and months of preparation, but they don't necessarily put any planning into preparing for marriage. And yet we expect so much. We expect so much of this primary relationship in our lives. You know, we expect this person to be our soulmate and to be our tennis partner and to be our total system of support and to be the bedrock of our families. But we don't actually want to learn what it takes to make a marriage survive.
The other thing, Ellen, that I think is interesting about weddings, and of course they're such joyful occasions and we all love going to them and celebrating the happy couple, but it's almost like there should be a bigger party for someone who's been together for 10 years and, you know, got up that morning and argued about, you know, who'd cleaned the microwave or whatever and still showed up that night to a wedding to celebrate another happy couple.
It's true. Oh, I think it's totally true. I mean, you know, listen, my cynicism pendulum has swung back and forth on weddings. When I started out, I was pretty cynical about the whole wedding industrial complex, and I was never into the stuff of weddings. But I came to really find the sacred in these ceremonies. So I think weddings are important, but I totally agree with you. The far greater achievement is what happens day in and day out after you say I do and after you walk back down the aisle together. And then you have to, you know, really make this thing work. And it is challenging. You know, I think one of the great lessons from the book, or one of the lessons that I hope to get across, is that, you know, we need to sort of go into it with eyes open so that when tough spots come down the pike, you know, we're not caught off guard and we know that they are par for the course.
You mentioned that, you know, we all expect relationships to be magical. These days, a lot of couples meet online, which does not make for a charming origin story at dinner parties. How much does that matter?
None. It matters none. But I thought it mattered a great deal. My parents have this amazing, you know, meet cute when Harry met Sally style story. And I thought that I needed to meet the right guy in the right way. And so I had reservations about doing online dating until I started interviewing all of these couples who met through online dating. And I would say that when I was writing the column, which was starting in 2009 and ending a couple of years ago, maybe 40 to 60% of the couples I was writing about met somehow online. The two women who write it today would say it's much higher than that. And let me tell you something. Every one of those couples who met online feels just as fated and feels that their meeting was absolutely as serendipitous as people who met during, you know, the Peace Corps or whatever. They felt drawn together. And listen, what drew them together might have been Match.com or Plenty of Fish or an old Facebook connection, but still something happened that drew them together. And frankly, how you meet lasts for one day or one moment. It's all the days after that really matter.
I had a friend once who was on one of the online dating services. I'm not sure which one. And he said, it might turn out that the women I meet here are not interested in dating me, but at least I know they're interested in dating, period.
Yeah. For me, what was really helpful about online dating was that, and I'm sure this is true in Dallas and in a lot of cities, and certainly it's true in smaller towns, is that every once in a while you can say to yourself, I have dated everyone out there. I know everyone and there's nobody left. There's nobody out there. And so what online dating did for me, and it didn't introduce me to my husband, so you could say it wasn't successful, but every time I logged on, it was a reminder to me that I hadn't met everyone, that there were more people out there, and that it was worth continuing the effort because you just never know.
Is it just about the fact that it reminds you that there's a volume of people, or is there something beneficial about the way these sites suggest people to one another? Is there something to those formulas?
I don't know. I mean, certainly they think that there is. To me, it's a numbers game. To me, this is where dating happens today. You know, I mean, nobody is going to approach you in the produce aisle. You know, no, probably nobody's going to strike up a conversation with you in the gym. We're all too busy looking at our cell phones. Even if you go out to a singles bar today, people are looking more at their cell phones and maybe even trying to attract somebody nearby with their cell phone using Tinder than they are likely to come up and say hello. It just doesn't happen anymore. And so, you know, I think that, listen, eHarmony has some really interesting numbers about their success rates. And they have produced a lot of marriages and a lot of happy marriages. And so I think that's great. But I also think that largely what they're doing is attracting a pool of marriage-minded people who are after the same thing and who want to meet each other. And this is a vehicle that brings them together in a way that nothing else does right now. So my message is, if you are still hesitant about online dating, it's time to get over it.
It's funny that you mentioned the produce aisle. That's actually how my parents met, but it was, you know, 1967. So things have changed.
That's amazing. Great.
I loved your story about Betty and Edgar, who had been married for 65 years when you met them. But when you broached the subject of soulmates, they both basically burst out laughing.
Oh, my gosh. So Betty and Edgar are one of my favorite couples, too. And I interviewed them pretty early on in my stint as a wedding reporter. And I went out. They had been married by that time for 65 years. They were both in their mid-80s. And I was there to learn, you know, the secret of their success. And I knocked on the door and it opened. And here are these, you know, two people, you know, both 3 feet tall, it seemed to me at the time, with matching canes and, you know, kind of toddled me back to their living room, which was overflowing with stacks of the New Yorker magazine that had been read, it seemed, actually. And we talked about what made a marriage work. And then at the end, I sort of turned off my recorder, as I often do, and just, you know, started having a candid conversation. And I said,
you know, people in my generation spend so much time talking and thinking and looking for the one, their soulmate. I said, what do you think about that idea? And Betty looked like she wanted to slap me. She really did. She just was disgusted. Her face fell and she said, what are you talking about? What are you guys doing today? She said, if I hadn't been married to Edgar for 65 years, I would have been married to somebody else for 65 years. Because to her, it wasn't about finding the right person. It was about being the right person and being committed. And so that always really stayed with me.
That's such a huge difference. We're always looking for the person who's going to do it for us, and without we just sort of assume that we're going to be perfect for somebody else.
Yeah, and we assume again that is the trick. The trick is to find the right person, and then it's game over. You know, I talked to one marriage therapist who kind of just shakes her head in disbelief. She said, you know, so often couples come to me and they've, you know, they're 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years into marriage and they've hit a really rough time and they're just having a rough go of it. And they say, you know, I thought I found the right person, but obviously, you know, it's hard now. And so must be, I didn't find the right person. I have to get a divorce and then go find the right person instead of saying, how can I be the right person? What can I do to make this work?
What have you learned about what you call the good on paper phenomenon and why it so often just does not hold water?
Because it's about what we need superficially. And I'm the first to say that I was so beholden to the idea of what I needed on paper because it was very specific. I needed somebody who was Irish Catholic and rooted for the Buffalo Bills. I mean, did I actually actively root for the Buffalo Bills? No, but whoever I was going to end up with certainly needed to. And I spent a long time looking for that person. And I found, you know, several people who seemed to match up. But of course, you know, when it came right down to it, that was just the superficials. It didn't end up meeting any of my real needs. I didn't end up feeling understood or heard. I didn't feel all the things that you need to feel when you are truly seen by someone. And so I tell people they have to sort of get out of their own way because I think that you can really miss it. One of my favorite couples is a couple named Nikki and Dan. And Nikki said she had one requirement for the guy she was going to marry, and he had to be able to reach the tall things on the shelf. Okay? So that's what she needed. Nikki ended up marrying a little person, a little person who came up, you know, not to her shoulder even. And she said, that's how I knew I really loved him, because I didn't care. And I think that once people let go of the idea of what they need on paper and what the pedigree should be, then so often they find themselves finding the real thing.
You know, and what's very interesting about that is we've all known people who had such high, not high expectations, but they set themselves up like, I'll only be with, you know, whatever, Mr. Universe or Miss Universe. And then they end up alone longer than maybe they needed to be alone if they wanted to be in a couple.
That's right. That's right. For several years, I was involved in a longstanding Washington tradition called Friend Swap, which is a big party that happens every year where singles invite friends of friends and everybody is matched up with 5 or 6 other singles. And they, you know, put in their specifications. And the people who come back year after year after year are the people with a list of specifications that runs about 8 pages long.
We're speaking this hour with Ellen McCarthy. Her new book is called The Real Thing: Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us with either a question or perhaps a suggestion for love and life, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org. Or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ellen McCarthy, who is a feature writer for The Washington Post and launched its On Love section in 2009. Her new book is called The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Ellen, when you were single and in your early 30s, you took what some people might consider a radical step. You froze some eggs to take the pressure off yourself in dating.
Yeah, I think it was probably more radical then than it is today. But the truth is I was panicked and I was waking up in the middle of the night, just in cold sweats because I felt like I needed to find the right person and I needed to find him immediately because I knew that I wanted to have children and I was always doing the mental math. Okay, you know, you meet somebody at 31 or 32, you date for a couple of years, you're engaged for a year or so, you know, you get married a couple of years after that, and then all of a sudden, you know, gosh, the biological clock is really ticking. And so that pressure was driving me crazy. I felt like I was becoming crazy. And more than that, I am really worried that fear and that worry would drive me to make a wrong decision, meaning that I would take the next comer and get into a mediocre marriage that was maybe not what I really wanted for myself and not what I wanted for my future children because of that pressure. And so I needed to do something to release the pressure valve. And that was the thing that I could do to regain my sanity mostly. And I know it's not for everyone, but it worked for me. It allowed me to relax and to enjoy dating a little bit again. By the time I actually, it took me a year to save up for it. It's an expensive procedure. And by the time I actually did it, I had met the man who was going to become my husband, and we had only been dating for a couple of months, and he's younger than me. And so it was a very odd conversation to have with a new boyfriend. Hey, I'm going to put my future kids on ice. How do you feel about that? But frankly, it was good news for him too, because then our relationship could develop at its own pace and not be beholden to, to the female fertility cycle. And so for me, it worked. But, you know, what I say about that in the book is to do anything that you can do to tamp down the panic. And maybe that means seeing a therapist. Maybe that means, doing the thing that you put on hold, going to grad school, moving to a new city, buying a house, you know, living your life really fully, because I think that only makes you more attractive.
Well, and the thing is that it's not true that everybody eventually finds somebody. And I was so interested in what you learned interviewing people who never did find a life partner, even though they might have wished for one at some point.
Yeah, I wrote a big magazine story that profiled several people who always assumed that they would find a lifelong marriage and did the work that it takes to put themselves in position to do that. And I think that we often don't talk about this in our society. We talk a lot today about people who are electing to live a single life, who are electing to become single parents. And I am all for that. But these were people for whom they really wanted a partnership and it just didn't happen. And we don't like to think that that's a possibility, but of course it is, of course it is. And their message, these people's message was, we're okay. You know, we ended up being okay. We're living full, rich lives. And the way that they got there was by, having some acceptance around the fact that maybe life didn't turn out exactly as they wanted. But they were still living it to the fullest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Joseph in Dallas. Hey, Joseph.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I just had a interesting anecdote about meeting my girlfriend on the internet. We didn't actually meet on a dating website. What we actually, we met at the Granada Theater here in Dallas. We were both attending a concert of a band that we both enjoyed, but we'd never met each other before that. But at the theater, between set, they have a projector on the wall, and you can tag the Granada Theater, and anything tagged shows up on that projector. So people can have conversations among themselves and see it up on the wall. And I ended up talking to her through Twitter at the concert, but I never physically met her. And we enjoyed talking so much that we did for the another year or so. So, excuse me, until we met in person. And we started dating about 2 weeks after that. And we've been together for 3 years now.
Yeah, that's a great story.
That's amazing.
It must be, I suppose you have an endless supply of stories that sound improbable and turned out to work for people. Do you ever, have you met couples that started with the romantic comedy trope of hating each other at first and then falling in love?
Yes. Yeah, I have. Well, one couple, in fact, you know, that they were both in the Army Reserves together, and she liked him, and he knew that she liked him, and he made it known to all of the other people in their unit that he thought she was the worst. And it finally got back to her, and she was really hurt. And then, of course, he actually got to know her and who's, you know, coming crawling back for who after that. So, yeah, of course, there's, you know, and that's people. It happens in all kinds of ways. You know, there are some people for whom it happens with a thunderbolt, and it happens with, you know, eyes meeting across a room and feeling chills. And people told me really amazing stories of knowing in an instant. But I also really loved the couples who had been, you know, friends forever, or roommates, actually, and nothing ever happened between them until one day it did. And it sparked and something turned. And so for me, the big takeaway was it can happen in any kind of way to all kinds of people every day. So you just never should cross anything off your list of possibilities.
So if we get all our information about relationships from, you know, movies, dating is the means, the wedding is the end. In real life, though, and you write beautifully about this, even the happiest couples have a big adjustment coming when they move in together. Sometimes it's before the wedding, sometimes it's after, but how is it that nobody talks about what one marriage educator you spoke to called the clash of civilizations?
Yeah, I loved that term. And frankly, I found it so helpful because we don't talk about, you know, what it means to merge two ways of being. You know, by the time my now husband and I moved in together, you know, we were both in our 30s. We had been doing things our own way for 3 decades. And we each thought that our own way, we still do, was the right way, you know? And then all of a sudden you have to merge your entire way of being with somebody else's entire way of being. And so, you know, we're supposed to have this honeymoon period where, oh, you get married and everything is bliss and vacations and, you know, dining al fresco with your gleaming new dishes. When in fact, it's often that is not how you load a dishwasher and
right. Chunked light tuna. What are you doing?
Right. What do you do? All these little things, you know? And so having that in mind for me that, no, this doesn't have to be a honeymoon period. This can be the clash of civilizations. And then you go through the clash and it gets easier after that was really helpful because, again, it took the pressure off. If you expect it to be all, you know, rainbows and butterflies, then you're setting yourself up for some disappointment.
And there is the whole thing that we all have to get over, which is expecting the person who loves us and who we love to be able to read our minds. We just so often don't want to tell them what we want. We want them to know because we believe that's what love should look like.
Yes, because they know us. And if they really loved us, they would understand that what I need from you right now is a peanut butter sandwich or whatever.
Yeah.
It is,
or a hug.
You know?
Yeah.
Yes, a hug or just to listen. Or, you know, I really need you to know exactly how to rub my head when I'm sad. Whatever it is. And people don't. people don't want, you know, this incredibly smart couple I met. They were both in their 20s. She was a social worker. And before they moved in together, she made them each write down a list of expectations so that they knew going into this cohabitation exactly what to expect of each other. And it was very detailed. If you have a rough day at work, where are you going to go when you get home? What is your expectation of me? What is your expectation of how much time we'll spend with your family? How about with my family? You know, all of these really detailed things that you would never necessarily think to ask somebody, but they were laid out. And so then there was a bit of a roadmap. You know, of course, things are always going to come up. But the fact is, most of us don't marry mind readers. We have to be able to communicate our needs so that our partners have a chance to meet them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to speak with my guest, Ellen McCarthy. Her new book is called The Real Thing. Let's go on the phone now to Jeremy in Dallas. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great discussion, and I'm glad that you guys are having this conversation because I've been single for my entire adult life. I'm 31 years old, and I've met someone who we work very well together, and she's great, love her to death, but she's much younger than me. She just turned 19, and, you know, for us, what we find is that we want the same things for each other and for our future. Our concern is, you know, our friends are kind of looking at us like we're insane. And, you know, I personally don't think that it should be an issue. But my question is, you know, what can be said about big age gaps versus traditional, you know, 5 plus or minus year healthy, quote unquote, relationships? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Jeremy. Good luck to you. Ellen, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess my thought is that it seems quite large right now. I think 11 years is the age difference now. 11 years isn't going to mean anything when one of you is 50 and the other is 61. And so I think that ultimately it won't matter. You know, you'll have sort of slightly different experiences of, you know, one of you grew up with the New Kids on the Block and somebody else grew up with, you know, the Backstreet Boys or whatever. But I think that those age differences ultimately become irrelevant. And so if it's right and working for you, then I would say tune out the noise.
I love this in the book. Love does not mean never saying you're sorry. It means saying you're sorry a lot.
A lot. And not just saying you're sorry, but being sincere in your apology. There was one study that showed, you know, people can say sorry, you know, up one side and down the other, but unless their partner actually believed that they meant it, it didn't matter. And so you can't just say sorry, 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 and think it's a get out of jail free card. You actually have to at least be believable in your show of remorse, because that really does make a difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You have been to weddings that, or you have met couples preparing to marry that you thought, this does not look good. How do you respond to that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So I'm always interviewing couples, usually a week or two before the wedding. And, you know, I'll sit down with them for an hour, 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours or more, and talk about why they love each other, how they met, and how they knew that this was the person they wanted to spend their life with. And sometimes by the end of the interview, what I'm thinking is, you guys, it's Wednesday. The wedding's not scheduled till Saturday. We can call it off. Look, I'll start calling the guests. Only one couple, by the way, ever actually did call it off between the space of the interview and the wedding. Unfortunately, all of the guests had already flown to the Dominican Republic for their destination wedding, but at least they were in a lovely place and had a, you know, cocktail in hand. Yes, if a couple can't get through an interview about why they love each other without bickering, if they can't bickering the entire time, I mean, if
if in answering the question, what do you love most about this person, you can only come up with, wow, that's a really hard one.
Oh, goodness.
That might not be such a good sign. So, yeah, you know, listen, I think that sometimes it's really tough. The train kind of leaves the station on couples when they've been together for a while, or they feel pressure to marry, or they've been living together, or they get engaged and then, you know, maybe know in their heart of hearts it's not right, but the vendors have been paid. And it puts people in a really tough position. But I'm always proud of the couples who, and I've had friends and close relatives who've done it, who called off the wedding because they knew it wasn't right.
And your sense is that we really should be behind people who feel like they need to call it off, because one, it's not easy, it's embarrassing, it's complicated, but it seems like it's very often the right thing to do.
Listen, oh my gosh, and the hardest thing to do, gosh, you know, it takes such integrity, I think, to say, I was wrong. I got into this thing. It wasn't right. I don't want to make my life and this other person's life worse by having just gone through with it for the sake of appearances. I think it's very difficult to do, but I also think divorce is very difficult. And so I think that people who do call it off because they know that it isn't right deserve a lot of credit.
And I guess if you think you're wasting money on, you know, paying caterers that won't serve your guests, just imagine paying divorce lawyers to divide up all your possessions, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. And I always say, you know, if you think it's painful now, think about the pain that would be caused for your future children. Because if when you keep them in mind, it puts everything in perspective.
Ellen McCarthy is my guest. She's a feature writer for The Washington Post who launched the On Love section for The Post in 2009. Her new book is called The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Washington Post feature writer Ellen McCarthy. Her new book is called The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Carmen in Garland. Hi, Carmen.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
I am a 36-year-old Christian IT professional who's traveled the world for work and personal, been in 24 countries on 5 continents. I'm Black. I have no children, very successful in my career, and I'm at the point where I'm trying to figure out if I should still try to hold out for my first boyfriend. I've been on Tinder, Match, Plenty of Fish, all of the websites, or if I should just go ahead and have a baby. I'm kind of at a crossroads, a baby with a friend.
Are you looking for advice from Ellen?
Yes.
All right. What do you think, Ellen?
Well, I don't think that I can tell you what to do. I think that, you know, you'll know in your gut when it's the right time to proceed on your own. And I think that there are a lot of really great examples of women who have done it on their own and men who've done it on their own. I also would tell you that I have covered several weddings of 35, 36-year-olds who, frankly, one couple, they were both virgins when they met and married at 35. They met at 35 and sort of didn't think it was going to happen. So I often think if you proceed with the to build the life that you want to live, and if that includes a child, then go for it. And that doesn't mean that the right person, you know, might not show up as you go along your path.
What does it take once you have found the person that you want to be with? You know, you mentioned people have these rough patches. What stops people from pushing through them in terms of our expectations about what marriage is?
I think it's largely our expectation that marriage just works itself out, you know, that we don't understand that there are going to be these predictable challenges and rough patches. And you know, it's been really well studied. You know, researchers can tell you, yes, the first couple of years of marriage are going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult when you have teenagers. It's going to be difficult when your teenagers leave and you suddenly find yourself sitting across from the table and it's a quiet house and maybe you don't have so much to say to each other anymore. And so I think that we, because we're not conditioned and taught to expect that to be the norm and to learn how to work through it, because I think that there are, you know, one of the things I learned from couples who'd been together for decades was that there's a real payoff. There's a real payoff for sticking to it, even during times when they thought it was really almost over. You know, there was one study that showed that couples who were highly dissatisfied in their marriage, and then they waited 5 years, and some of them had divorced, and some of them just kind of stuck it out. And the people who stuck it out were far happier than the people who got divorced. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that the divorce isn't the right answer for people. I think it's a case-by-case basis, and certainly in instances of abuse or neglect or, you know, addiction, it obviously is. But I think for some people, you know, it can be an out that looks really attractive because the grass is greener, and then maybe they find that it, you know, that was an illusion.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Emily is on the line in Denton. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I love what you're talking about today, and I just wanted to comment that my husband and I have been together for 22 years, and we were not going to make it. I mean, we just were destined for divorce court, and we turned to our faith. And a lot of what you're saying about just sticking to marriage and working through those tough times, just it enhances and strengthens marriage. And I'm certainly not evangelical, but in researching our Catholic faith, we learn more about the sacrament of marriage, and it really helped kind of give us a plan and an understanding of what the commitment was. And now we're just flourishing. We've got two kids, and just, you know, I just love to hear what that support of marriage, even when it gets tough, you know, is just where it's at.
Thank you so much for your call, Emily. Anything you want to respond to there, Ellen?
Yeah, I mean, I would say congratulations, first of all, because, you know, as Chris mentioned earlier, we should probably be throwing a giant party for you, you know, who really kind of battled through it and stuck through the tough times, rather than a couple who's just walking down the aisle after having, you know, dated for a couple of years, because that really is the real achievement. But as you're seeing, Emily, it also is the real payoff, you know, that you have this partner who has been with you now for a couple of decades. And, you know, I say in the book that to me, it's always seemed that some large part of being in a relationship is having someone who's, you know, has been there to bear witness to your life, who's seen how hard you struggled, who's seen everything that you've overcome, who's seen, you know, how hard you're working day in and day out with everything you do in life. And so, you know, as so many couples told me after, you know, their 50th or 60th wedding anniversary, it can be really worth it to just stick with it and do the work.
I was fascinated by this. You say that psychologists think it's important for partners to allow their thoughts and behaviors to be influenced by their partners. You don't necessarily have to do things the way your family of origin did them or the way you did them when you were single. It can actually be beneficial to a relationship to bend in many ways.
Yeah. I remember talking to this one woman and she said, you know, you put your broom where your mother put her broom, and where she put her broom was in the pantry. And her sister-in-law said, why is your broom in the pantry? It should be next to the refrigerator where it belongs. You know, where it, because, of course, that's where it belongs. And we all think, again, whatever way we've done things or seen things done is the right way. And so we can either sort of you know, stick our feet in the mud and get entrenched, or we can say, okay, I'm open to being influenced and having some flexibility around these issues. And it can be small issues like where you put your broom, or it can be larger issues like how do we spend money? What kind of traveling do we want to do in life? And feeling that you're willing to take on a little bit of your partner's way in the world, and whether that means their personality or what matters to them, can really go a long way.
Lots of people these days talk about their commitment being more important than a piece of paper that legally ties them together. But you were left by going to all these weddings with the feeling that there is something important about wedding ceremonies.
Yeah, and I say ceremonies in particular. I think that there is something very important about the entire wedding, meaning the party and the hoopla. But I think that there is something very sacred about wedding ceremonies, and it's often such an overlooked factor in weddings. You know, we spend a lot of time planning what are we going to serve at dinner? What are the appetizers going to be? Picking out dresses and flowers and, you know, bridesmaid colors and all of that. And people often overlook what's going to happen at the ceremony, and that is where something changes, and life is going to be different when you walk back down the aisle than it was when you walked up it. And so I often tell couples to really think through what do you want to have happen up there. You know, there's almost always room for some kind of personalization in a wedding ceremony. And when I talk to couples after the fact and I say, what was the highlight of the day? They almost never say, oh, the cake, or, you know, I just really loved, you know, the way the flowers look. They say the ceremony. They say, you know, seeing my bride or my groom for the first time, or walking down the aisle with my mom or my dad, or looking out and seeing all of these people who love us looking back, that was what really mattered. And so I think it's important to put as much forethought as possible into what you want to have happen up there.
Back to the phones now. This time let's speak with John in Joshua. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for let me call in, but I just wanted to say I've been married 42. I'll be married 42 years in August, mm-hmm. And it's been the easiest thing I ever did. I mean, it's been great.
No fighting, no struggles, nothing.
We fought twice.
Wow!
But basically, she taught me that you need to think of. I think of her before I do anything, and she thinks of me before she does anything.
Sounds like a formula for success.
Yeah, it is. And it's actually, in some ways, a scientifically proven one. There was one study that showed they had couples do an experiment where they, every 6 months, they were asked to journal about something. And half the couples journaled about an argument, and they did it from the standpoint of an observing third party who was supportive of the relationship. And so they wrote about a conflict from that standpoint. And the other couples wrote about a conflict, or they wrote about something unrelated. And the couples who could get outside of themselves and think about their conflict from the standpoint of a supportive third party, meaning I'm going to think of the relationship and the marriage as being more important than my particular needs or your particular needs, ended up being far more satisfied in the marriage than the other couples. So there is really something to be said for that, for putting the priority on your partner's needs and maybe even more than that, on what's best for the relationship's needs.
What do you think about the effect of social media on how it causes all of us to think about our relationships with our significant other? Because nobody ever says, you know, we had a big fight this morning, or we just can't agree on what to do about, you know, preschools for the kids. People only write about the anniversary dinners and the long walks they took and the fabulous vacations.
Oh, my gosh. And the happy pictures, and everybody's so glossy and beautiful all the time. Yeah, it's terrible. You know, I think that there's always a temptation to compare yourself and your relationship to those of other people. And it's such a dangerous game. It's such a dangerous game because, of course, particularly on social media, people are only putting their best, shiniest selves forward. But also, you know, even your closest friends, even your siblings, even your, the person you may think you know everything about, you don't know everything about their relationship. There's only two people in any given relationship, assuming it's a two-person relationship. And if you're not one of those two people, then you can never really know what's happening. And so it's so useless and, frankly, detrimental to even bother to compare ourselves to anybody else.
All right, let's go very quickly to one last call here. We have Ryan on the line in Denton. Hey, Ryan.
Hello. Well, I just have a question about, I'm married, or I'm engaged, going to be married. I'm already thinking that I'm married because we've been living together for a couple of years. And the wedding's in August. We've been engaged over a year. And about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I got kind of a panic attack. I had really cold feet. I had to drive to my parents' house in the middle of the night. And I was just worried that my fiance, I love her, and I know that she's going to be a great mother, and she is a great fiance. She never does anything wrong. I'm just wondering if just because she's good enough, does that mean that, I'm not sure if I believe in soulmates or anything like that, but is that reason enough to get married, or is it a mistake when I could roll the dice and go and try to find somebody who is better than her? Or should I just, you know, cut my losses and be grateful with what I have and, you know, just stay where I'm at?
Well, thank you so much for your call, Ryan. That's a heavy question. What do you think,
Ellen? Heavy question. Yeah, listen, again, I don't know what's going to be best for you, but I will say that one of the best pieces of advice that I ever picked up, by eavesdropping on a conversation conducted by a yoga instructor. And she was talking to her friend about a career decision. And she said to her friend, your mind can lie to you. You know, you can lie to yourself mentally, but you can never lie to yourself physically. In your body, you always know the right thing to do. And so I think that that is really wise. If you can, you know, listen to how you feel physically in the company of this person, you know, do you feel at home? Do you feel fully comfortable? Do you feel really at ease and like you are not necessarily your best self, but your whole, real, authentic self? Then I think that those are really good signs. If, on the other hand, you are walking on eggshells or sucking in your stomach or, you know, waiting till your fiance leaves the room to exhale, then I think that those are signs you need to pay attention to.
Ellen McCarthy is a feature writer for The Washington Post who launched the paper's On Love section in 2009. Her new book is called The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. Ellen, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. On Twitter, I'm at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.